Today, with the abortion pill coming to major drug chains, attorney Steve Crampton describes the potential fallout.
The employees of Walgreens and CVS, who may have religious objections to participating in this thing, are now going to have lawsuits possible.
Then, what happens when your bank cancels your account for no apparent reason? We'll talk about debanking and why it happens.
When federal law enforcement comes in and puts their thumb on the scale on this, I mean, what do you think a bank is going to do? They're definitely going to flag the customer.
Also, a longtime friend and colleague remembers Don Wildman.
It was not uncommon for him to keep the nursery. And the next week, he might be at the White House.
It's the weekend of March 23rd and 24th. I'm Jeff Shambly, and this is The Stand Radio. Well, if you thought that the battle over the sanctity of human life was won with the overturning of Roe v. Wade, then this headline might wake you up. Mifepristone abortion pills to be carried at CVS Walgreens. The fact is, the battle to protect the unborn has reached a new level. And Steve Crampton, assistant to the general counsel here at AFA, is with us to shed some light on where all this is heading. Hi, Steve.
Great to be with you, Jeff.
Companies don't make these kinds of decisions without taking into account what the public is going to think about it. Does this mean that the marketplace is now more accepting of this as a way of life?
You know, I think there's a bit of wishful thinking in that.
Okay.
Polls show that for the Democrats, abortion access is like the number one issue.
Yeah.
So it's clearly hotly contested. And as you say, post-Dobbs, the Biden administration has pretty much bet the farm on the abortion issue, right? They're vigorously prosecuting pro-lifers under their civil rights division of the DOJ. There is this notion that somehow the sky has fallen as a result of Dobbs. And I think, frankly, that companies like Walgreens and CVS want to be on the cutting edge and kind of make a PR statement more than reflect what they think the public really is about nowadays. It's a very risky decision as a matter of business practice, it seems to me.
Attorneys general from 20 states have sent a letter to CVS and Walgreens with a warning that if they proceed with this, at least if they mail these pills out, they could be in violation of state and federal law. What does the law say about distribution of this drug?
That is actually a fascinating question, because what we have on the books is what was called the old Comstock Law, passed in like the 1870s. Mm-hmm. That's the federal law that was cited by the attorneys general, in addition to recent state laws that have gone into effect, banning abortion and so forth. But the DOJ of the Biden administration, of course, isn't going to touch that old federal law. And there is some debate even among other legal scholars whether it's really valid in this context. But on its face, it does prohibit this kind of practice if you're mailing these abortion drugs. But what it's going to come down to, I think, is a state-by-state kind of case of enforcement. And how difficult is it, Jeff? Think about it. Mm-hmm. Are we asking federal or state officials to monitor our mail to ascertain whether we're receiving illegal drugs and all? I mean, that's a pretty disturbing proposition in itself. So you've got a real enforcement problem here.
Okay.
And although 20 states, rightly, I think, issued that aggressive letter, that leaves 30 that didn't.
Okay.
So we are a nation divided, and this is one of those issues. I mean, really, it looks a lot like the lead up to the Civil War. We're so dramatically of two minds on the issue of fundamental protection for innocent life.
Now, there was some issue of the FDA skirting its own requirements for this drug. Would you tell us about that?
Yes. There is a case now pending at the U.S. Supreme Court. Cert has been granted. Arguments are set for later, I think, this month. So we'll have a decision by the end of June regarding the issue whether the FDA ignored its own restraint and guidelines in opening the door to mailing these drugs. There really haven't been any new considerations of studies or anything like that. The FDA basically just did an about-face. And so once again, I think, Jeff, what you have here is a case of the politicizing of everything that's in place. You can't really trust science anymore, you know? You've got experts on both sides that are politicized, and you can't trust federal agencies that in the past would really protect food and drug on a basis of neutrality and whether it's really harmful.
It's been estimated that 50% or more of all abortions now are done through medication or through a pill, through a chemical.
Yes.
How dangerous is mifepristone to women, Steve?
Sort of goes back to that FDA question.
Okay.
Some experts would say really dangerous. Others, oh, it's harmless. And remember, too, Jeff, how we got to the legalization of surgical abortions in the first instance. They argued aggressively that you can't do this at home. It's very dangerous. Now what are they saying? Oh, you can do it at home. It's perfectly safe.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And so I think the best evidence is it's dramatically more risky to the women. Pay no attention, of course, to the preborn child that's being destroyed in these processes. Some estimates are as high as 6 times more dangerous than the surgical kind of process. Moreover, remember, you have no medical supervision. These women, many of whom are desperate, many have not done any research themselves. They don't know their own gestational age of their child.
Okay.
And so you've got no follow-up. It's a disastrous situation, I think, medically.
Let's talk about the liability that could be in place for this drug. What sort of things could CVS and Walgreens face as a result?
Oh, I think the liability exposure is huge here because they are going to be in the process of administering drugs that can result in death of the mother. Complications, obviously, to the preborn child. There's also, by the way, conscience laws that will kick in, right? The employees of Walgreens and CVS who may have religious objections to participating in this thing are now going to have lawsuits possible in pushing back against being forced to administer the drugs. It's just a Pandora's box of legal liability. It's extraordinary what we face here.
We're not dealing with antibiotics or steroids.
Exactly. And of course, then you've got the complication of the women who think, well, I'm ashamed of doing it. That's why I'm doing it in the dark at home anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
They're probably not going to report most of their disastrous side effects.
Mm.
If they show up at the hospital, they may lie. In fact, they're encouraged by some abortion providers to lie about why you're there. And so it's just a mess.
It is a mess. Steve, March for Life posted on their X account, formerly Twitter. They said, time to boycott CVS and Walgreens. Pharmacies should be places that provide medication to help life, not end it. Mm. We live in a free market economy. Do you see people choosing to leave these companies for another place for their prescriptions?
I certainly hope so. I got to say amen to that call. You know, AFA has a great history of calling for boycotts. Ultimately, we are still, by and large, a nation of the people, right? And when the people take a firm stance on something like this, companies like Walgreens and CVS have no choice but to listen, else they go out of business. So I, for one, will be taking my business elsewhere.
All right. Steve, thanks for giving us your insight here.
Thank you, Jeff.
Well, if you think political persecution is limited to third world countries, think again. Here in the United States, holding the wrong beliefs can get you censored by some of the largest companies in the world. Who's behind this and what is the government's role? Attorney Michael Ross with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom, is here to explain. Mr. Ross, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff.
Your organization, ADF, testified before a House subcommittee on the weaponization of the federal government on the issue of debanking. Tell us what debanking is.
Yeah, debanking is when these large financial institutions start politicizing their services to cancel or deny service to customers because of that customer's political or religious views. And unfortunately, it's something that we've seen happening with increasing regularity, and we think that the danger is only accelerating.
Give us an example of who is being debanked. What sort of persons or entities?
Absolutely. So, I mean, it ranges the full spectrum of conservative and religious groups. One of our clients, Indigenous Advance, is a Memphis, Tennessee-based charity that operates to serve widows, orphans, and at-risk populations in Uganda. And they had been operating since 2015, and it had a Bank of America account, you know, from that point all the way up until April 2023, when right before one of their mission trips, they got a letter from Bank of America saying that we've decided to close your account because you're operating in a business type that we have chosen not to service. They had never given them any notification, any warning, never expressed any concern about any of this before. And the Indigenous Advance was left to scramble to try and shift funds around, to make payroll. They had to delay payroll to many of their Ugandan workers who work hand-to-mouth for a couple weeks. They had to reduce aid on that ministry trip, and the whole thing was a nightmare. And it left their founder, Steve Happ, wondering, you know, what had he done wrong, and is he going to encounter something like this again?
That is incredible. So no other reason, no other rationale other than you're operating in a business we no longer want to support. That's all they got.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nuts. And he asked repeatedly for an explanation. They sent a follow-up letter on his credit account a month later and said, well, you know, your business type exceeds our bank's risk tolerance. And they would never give him any more explanation. They just read back the two letters. And they closed the account of a local church that Steve Happ is affiliated with, but that it only occasionally donates to the ministry called Servants of Christ. And you know, the telling thing here is that it was not until several months later when an international news media organization, Daily Mail, spoke to Bank of America that Bank of America tried to reverse engineer some solutions. And, you know, they don't hold any water, but it just goes to show you that, you know, these banks are not dealing in good faith.
Now, are the banks operating alone in this, or are there other entities behind it?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know for sure because the entire thing is shrouded in way too much confidentiality and secrecy. And there are too many closed doors in this area, but it's very likely that there's other points of pressure here. You know, a very good indicator we got was the House Judiciary Committee's Select Subcommittee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government. They released a report a couple of weeks ago on which we testified last week explaining how federal law enforcement officials were pressuring banks and encouraging banks to profile as potential domestic terrorists, Americans with mainstream conservative views, Americans who donate to religious groups, to groups that are labeled extremist by the federal government, or who are associated with a number of quote-unquote hate groups, including Alliance Defending Freedom.
Michael, is there any relationship between this debanking and some of the other reports that we've gotten of banks looking into the financial transactions of their customers and flagging them as conservative?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the banks are denying service to a lot of these individuals, and Indigenous Advance is just one of several. Okay. We have 19 examples up right now. We keep a rolling list on our website, viewpointdiversityscore.org. And it's usually under reputational risk policies saying doing business with you presents a reputational risk to our bank because of your, you know, whatever views or social status or whatever it is that the bank considers, you know, to be a blight on your reputation. Another way that they do this is, you know, saying, well, we're concerned about money laundering or foreign terrorism. And that's an example that is not often trotted out publicly, but when Sam Brownback, the former governor, U.S. Senator, ambassador, had his organization debanked, they said that was a concern of his, you know, because, you know, he was such a nefarious individual. This guy's like an upstanding U.S. citizen. So there's a number of different levers that we're seeing, but when federal law enforcement comes in and puts their thumb on the scale on this, I mean, what do you think a bank is going to do? They're definitely going to flag the customer.
What kind of recourse does someone have when they've been notified that their account is being closed?
Yeah, unfortunately, not a lot. There's not a right to appeal. I mean, if you think that there's been religious discrimination, you know, there are certain areas, certain states that have protections. Not all of them do. But even then, the banks can come up with any number of vague reasons and try and reverse engineer something to make it very difficult. Ron Lieber, a journalist for the New York Times, wrote about the problem here back in either December or November about how banks just close people's accounts without reason and without notice and warning, and that, you know, we need to have more transparency. The banks need to have more dialogue with customers in this area.
We're speaking with ADF attorney Michael Ross about debanking. Michael, are there any strategies that companies and individuals can apply to sort of minimize their risk of being debanked?
Yeah, you certainly can. I mean, the report that came out from the House subcommittee identified a lot of these big major financial institutions. Some of the biggest ones are really some of the most problematic in this space. Think Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo. They also have a really bad track record of debanking individuals. And so, you know, I would say, you know, steer away from them. We have a website where we score the country's largest financial institutions on how well they respect free speech and religious liberty through the Viewpoint Diversity Score. And you can see if they have bad customer-facing policies, like, you know, reputational risk policies. Another big lever is hate speech or intolerance policies. Mm-hmm. And so you want to try and avoid banks that have those in their terms of service.
That's good. Let me give that website one more time, because that would be helpful for people to check out. ViewpointDiversityScore.org. ViewpointDiversityScore.org. We'll also put a couple of links on our podcast page of articles and PDFs that people may find informative. One of them is an article by Kristen Wagoner titled "When Big Banks Discriminate." And the other is a PDF of Alliance Defending Freedom's testimony before this House subcommittee. Michael Ross with Alliance Defending Freedom, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
The entire month of March is dedicated to remembering the life and legacy of the late Donald E. Wildman, president and founder of American Family Association. One man who's been a close friend of Don through the years is Michael Murfree. He's also been a board member here at AFA as well. He's with us today to share some of his favorite memories with us. Mike, welcome to the Stand Radio.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
Tell us when you first came to know Don Wildman.
That would have been 1975. My wife and I, we were dating at the time. And Brother Don was the minister at Cornerstone Methodist. At that time, it was called Lee Acres Methodist Church. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I went to her church because we were dating, and I thought that it was important that I make a good impression with her parents. So being at church, I think that was a good way to do it.
And he was pastor at that time?
He was.
Okay.
Yes.
Very good.
Yes.
Now, you've known him for over 50 years. Tell me what his influence was like in your life, because that's a long time to know someone.
It is. You know, the influence he had on me did not come through AFA or the mm-hmm. National Federation for Decency. It was just our personal relationship that we had. And to be honest, Jeff, God used him to help shape me to the person that I am today. Hmm. I had wonderful parents. My father was a great man, did all that he could with me. Mm-hmm. But God knew that I needed a second helping.
Okay.
You know, and he put Don in my life, and Don's family, too.
His wife, Linda.
Yes, Linda.
Yeah, yeah. In what ways was he an influence on you in those years? Did you spend a lot of time together working around the church, or did you just have chances to be with him maybe outside of the church environment?
Well, he married my wife and I, mm-hmm. baptized my wife. He baptized both of my children. Mm-hmm. So he was very much a part of my family through church. But, you know, Brother Don was an individual that I could reach out to. He was a mentor.
Oh, okay.
And so any time that I needed, I had a question or a problem or a challenge that I was facing, I could always count on Brother Don to give me advice, and good advice, and advice that I knew was prayed over.
How did you see Brother Don as a pastor interact and serve the church?
Well, as a teenager, I always remember his sermons were very short, and so I appreciated that. And I'm serious, 15 to 20 minutes, that would have been a long sermon for Brother Don. But the wisdom that he could impart in that short period of time was just incredible. Mm. And, you know, his sermons were absolutely straight out of the Bible.
Yeah.
And he could deliver them in a way that even a teenager that had no knowledge of the Bible could understand. A person could grasp that and learn from it and use it in their life, in their daily life. And you and I probably have both sat through sermons before that they were kind of lengthy and lofty.
They could have been abbreviated. We'll put it that way.
And you walk away with, you know, you don't really feel like you've learned a lot. With Brother Don, he did not have to spend a lot of time. And he would often say, when asked about the length of his sermons, that the mind will absorb what your rear end can endure. And he had a gift, and boy, God used it.
You saw him interact with children around the church. And I heard some of your comments in the memorial service. Tell our listeners just a little bit about what you observed, Don, maybe on more of the humorous side or some of the unexpected things that people may not have anticipated him to be involved with.
Don loved children. I mean, he absolutely loved children. And, you know, it was not uncommon for him to keep the nursery. Huh. We're talking about toddlers.
Toddlers,
you know.
Yeah.
And down on his knees on the floor, you know, trying to keep him corralled, you know, and the next week he might be at the White House. You know what I mean? He's just such a humble individual and always wanted to serve, whether that was in the nursery or as a Sunday school teacher. And he was an excellent Sunday school teacher. But, you know, as far as humor, we used to have a talent show at the church. And I don't know if it was like a biannual thing or what, but I can't remember. We had a gentleman there that was a part of our congregation, extremely talented, a singer, a guitarist. And so he talked Brother Don into coming up and singing with him, and, you know. So, Brother Don did not know what he was getting into, of course, and but the kids, they were all up on the front row, and so he talked Brother Don into putting on a wig.
A wig.
Like a, I think it was a purple or pink hair wig, and I believe that he had a broom in his hands for a guitar, and he's up, you know, in the front of the church with this gentleman, singing Poke Salad Annie. And it wasn't just the children that were laughing. The adults in that congregation were about to fall out of their chairs.
I'm sure.
And it was so unexpected. You just, you know, I had seen Don's humorous side before. I'm not so sure Don would have done that if he had known what the song was going to be. But
he was a good sport.
He was a great sport.
Yeah.
And, oh, goodness, the kids just loved that.
Mike, you served on the board here at AFA for a long time. You saw the development of American Family Association and American Family Radio. Tell us about some of the times that different projects were suggested and maybe were a little riskier than others. Where did those kinds of ideas come from, do you think?
Well, I mean, as far as like building out a radio network, huge risk involved in that, and little funds to do it with.
Okay,
you know, so anybody that was serving on the board at that time probably had some reservations about that. Don was a risk taker. I mean, he was a risk taker. But that said, He was also a prayer warrior, and I mean he took his prayer life very seriously, and when you understood that, and you understood that that God was with him, well, you can afford to take risk.
Yeah,
when the opportunity presents itself, and there's risk involved, if you know that God is with you, and that power is there with you. And that's where you feel like he is leading you, then you take those risks.
Mm-hmm. Good way to put that. One last question for you, Mike. If there is one principle that we could learn from the life of Don Wildman, what would that be?
Integrity and faithfulness. Integrity was everything to him. He once said, without it, you've got nothing.
Yeah.
And it is just so true. And it plays into our spiritual life. It plays into, in its huge way, it plays into our relationships, mm-hmm. in the way that we conduct business, whether it's through a ministry, an organization, or a corporation, or whatever. And everything that Don did, he did with integrity. And he expected his family to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And the people, or the men and women at AFA, and everybody that he surrounded himself with, he expected integrity. He demanded it, and he lived it. And if there was one thing, that would be it. And of course, his faithfulness. Jeff, you know, when God called him into this, you know, he left the pulpit. He left a job that actually paid a salary.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness, what kind of faith did that take? He had 4 children at the time to feed, and he could not even have fathomed at that time how his family would be persecuted through his desire to wake the nation up to our moral decay. And when he experienced that, you know that he really had to double down on his faith.
Yeah.
And he did.
Mm-hmm.
And look at what God did with it. Is that not incredible?
Mm.
I'm just blown away. Lives will be changed because of this ministry. People will be drawn to the saving grace of Jesus Christ. You know, what greater legacy could a person leave?
Yeah.
Faithfulness. That's where it all started. And, of course, integrity.
All right. Thanks so much, Mike, for coming by and sharing your thoughts. It's been a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you, Jeff.
Join us next time as we explore the centrality of the resurrection of Jesus to the Christian faith. Pastor and writer Matthew White tells us what happens when church leaders choose to spiritualize it rather than take it literally. We'll also look at how online activism can make a difference in the advertising your children see and hear. If you've missed a part of today's program or would like to check out guest information or share a link with someone, just visit our podcast page at afr.net. And for key articles on culture, faith, and family, get your free 6-month subscription to The Stand magazine by going to afa.net/The Stand. I'm Jeff Shambly. Join us again next time here on The Stand Radio.